my name's Martin Young, and this is Who Goes There, the biographical quiz show which lifts the lid on the famous and the infamous from history. Joining team captain Francis Wheen this week is Sue Cook, writer and broadcaster. And on Fred Housego's team, we have Annabel Giles, broadcaster and writer. Before we start, just a quick note about the scoring. There are 2 points available for a full and correct answer. 1 point for an answer which is partially correct, with bonuses up for grabs throughout the show. And we start, as usual, with an archive round. Each of you will hear the voice of a famous person. You have to tell me who it is. For you, Francis, whose voice is this? Can you work out who he's talking about?
I saw only photographs, which were very beautiful, but I had no notion of how she danced or anything. Only when I saw her do Giselle, and particularly Swan Lake touched me, and I found her incredibly young, youthful, like eternal youth. That's what my compliment would be. And she still has that, you know, at that age of 58. She's still young as Juliet I have known.
Francis, that's got to be a clue to the end, hasn't it?
Well, yes. I imagine it's Rudolf Nureyev talking about Dame Margot Fonteyn.
It certainly is. Well done.
He was never made a dame, was he, poor old Nureyev?
He was born in Irkutsk, Russia, in 1938, defected to Paris in 1961 while he was touring with the Kirov Ballet, and his socializing with French friends had worried the Soviets, and they were thinking that they might never let him leave the Soviet Union again. But he escaped at a Paris airport and claimed political asylum. And, of course, he formed that partnership with Fonteyn and later turned to directing and choreography. For you, Sue, have a listen to this.
I think that in England it got to the stage where running was almost destroying me, in a sense, because I didn't enjoy running at all anymore. And I just decided, if I'm not going to do anything now, I'll lose my love for running and everything that I feel for running. And that's why I decided to take a break off running, to recuperate in a way and get my love for running back and my will to run and compete back again.
It's Zola Budd,
yes, the little runner. Yes, very good.
I've just got memories. I can't even remember what year it was, but I remember her running barefoot, didn't she?
Yes.
And she was South African, and then there were all sorts of political problems, and she left South Africa, and I don't know what became of her.
Well, she was rushed through as a British citizen, whereas everyone else has to bung in an application to the Home Office and then hang around for several years while they lose the forms down in Croydon somewhere. She turned up, and because South Africa wasn't participating in the Olympics at the time, Thatcher's government immediately gave her British citizenship in about 5 minutes flat. She hung around in London for a while, then went back to South Africa and was never seen again. She's there to this day.
A comprehensive reply there. Now, this next one is for you, Annabel.
Oh, dear.
Who is this explaining how he came by his name?
My father was a grotesque comedian, and my mother was the ingenue soubrette, the singer and dancer in the show. I fell down a flight of stairs when I was around 6 months old. They picked me up, and no bruises, and didn't seem to hurt myself. And Houdini says, that was a... And the old man says, that's a good name. We'll call him that.
No.
What is interesting, listening to the voices, that you've never really heard the voice before. It was not the talkies, it was before that.
Oh, so therefore, so we're not Charlie Chaplin, it's one of those Buster Keaton-y type of Buster Keaton.
One of those Buster Keaton-y
the other
Buster
one,
Keatons.
Not Buster.
No, that's right.
Well, cheers, Buster Keaton.
You got there. It was the great silent movie star Buster Keaton, whose famous deadpan expression led to his other nickname, a great stone face. Fred, your great stone face. Here's your mystery voice.
I do the bulk of my work away from the paper. When travelling around, when walking, when driving cars, in trains, not in aeroplanes, which I don't enjoy so much, I actually go to the paper at a very late stage in the creation, and then I work to a set routine. Only when I'm in Alba at home, I work from as early in the morning as I can until lunchtime, then break in the afternoon for walking and considering what I have done, and then again late afternoon to early evening.
Can you imagine being trapped in a telephone box having a conversation like that?
It was Aldborough was the clue. Obviously, it's dear old Benjamin Britten.
It was the voice of Benjamin Britten, born in Lowestoft, Suffolk, in 1913. Britten became a life peer in 1976, which sadly was also the year of his death. Our next round is called The Time, the Place. I'll give each of you a year and a location, and I want you to tell me for whom that time and place were significant. In each case, I'm looking for the names of two major protagonists. First one's for you, Francis. The time is November 1871, and the place is Ujiji in what is now Tanzania.
Well, it's the meeting, the great meeting of Dr. Livingstone and H.M. Stanley.
He's got it right!
At which Stanley, he's had all these months trekking through the jungle in search of this man, comes up to him, sees first white man for several weeks, says, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. And you think, if only Livingstone had had the common sense to say, no, sorry.
History doesn't recount what Livingstone said in return, but for a bonus point, why might it have been appropriate if he'd expressed his surprise at seeing Stanley, again, the only white man he'd seen for a while, with the words, Gordon Bennett!
Oh, is this something to do with the newspaper that Stanley worked for? It was edited by Gordon Bennett, probably.
It was edited by Gordon Bennett. That's definitely a bonus point. Well done. James Gordon Bennett was the proprietor of the New York Herald, from whom the expression Gordon Bennett is derived. For you, Sue, the time is June 1956, and the place is the Woolton Church Fete.
Rock and roll era?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Maybe two quite famous people in the rock and roll, or soon to become famous. One was running the jam stall, the other one was doing the hoopla.
Yep.
It was Lennon and McCartney, was it?
It certainly was. Well done. Very good. The 13-year-old McCartney was taken by a mutual friend to see the 15-year-old Lennon skiffle band. Do you know what that skiffle band was called?
The Quarrymen.
The Quarrymen, yeah.
This
hardly worth asking the questions, is it? Very good, well done. A rather more recent one for you, Annabelle. The time is July 1999.
Oh, no.
And the place is Luttrellstown Castle near Dublin.
Oh, that's Posh and Beckham, isn't it?
Isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
Goodness
for that.
So, you were there, obviously.
Was, clearly I was invited. I was one of the thrones they sat on. No. it was sort of a huge... There's even a video. I mean, it's bad enough watching a video of a friend's wedding. You watch a video of somebody else's wedding, where there's the doves and the sort of purple and there's sort of not enough musicians to make a quartet. She only wanted a trio and, oh, what a palaver.
Well, I mean, the great news about it, of course, was that the little baby Brooklyn will grow up blessed with his parents' talents. He'll sing like David Beckham and play football like a Spice Girl. Sorry, Brooklyn, you've got a rotten name already and I'm being rude about you on the radio. It's not fair. Now, in this round, Fred, it's you finally. The time is July 1972. The place is Reykjavik.
This is chess, isn't it? Fisher and Spassky. Yeah. What was it? Fisher sort of went completely off his trolley and said they were using vibes in the audience to sort of move his king about when he weren't looking at all.
It was in Reykjavik in the summer of 1972 that Fisher challenged the Russian Boris Spassky for the World Chess Championship. Tensions between their respective nations were running so high at the time that both sides saw the match as the Cold War fought out in miniature. Fisher eventually won, only to relinquish his title 3 years later when he refused to defend it against another Russian...
Karpov, was it?
Karpov. Oh, you're good. You're good, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Anatoly Karpov. Right, let's have a quick look at the scores after the first two rounds. And they're absolutely level pegging. Francis and Sue have 10. Fred and Annabelle have 10. Our next round looks at what famous people say about themselves. In this case, the recreations they admit to in Who's Who. I'll give each of you three recreations and three names, all of which are from the world of politics. Your job's to match the right name to the right professed hobby. Let's start. Three new Labour men for you. Francis, Gordon Brown, Peter Mandelson, and Chris Smith. And among their recreations are mountaineering, swimming, and imaginatively enough, reading and writing. So, it's good to know that they can, isn't it? It cheers you up. So, Francis, can you please match the politicians to their passions?
Well, I hope so, yes. Chris Smith is mountaineering. He's a very serious mountaineer.
Yes.
And he wanders lonely as a cloud up in the Lake District. when he was at Cambridge, he did a PhD on the idea of solitude in Wordsworth. He's a very thoughtful man, Chris Smith. Doesn't always come across, but he is. And he's a proper mountaineer. Gordon Brown is a reading and writing man. Doesn't get out much, but likes to read and write. And Mandelson keeps himself fit and indeed supple, I think would probably be the word, by swimming.
Well done, that's absolutely right. The only thing you didn't mention was that Gordon Brown can do reading and writing, but he makes no mention of arithmetic. Three former Tory cabinet ministers for you, Sue. Kenneth Clark, Michael Howard, and Lord St. John of Fawsey. And among their stated leisure activities were bird watching, appearing on TV, and watching the New York Mets play baseball. Sort that lot out.
Kenneth Clark probably is the bird watcher, actually.
Yes.
I think he goes to Norfolk and twitches. Michael Howard loved appearing on television until that famous interview by Jeremy Paxman. And then it put him off a little bit. So I would have thought that Michael Howard likes watching the New York Mets play baseball.
That's correct. Well done.
Which leaves Norman appearing on television and enjoying it.
Lord St. John of Fawsey does enjoy appearing on television.
It's very modest of him, though, because he doesn't say he enjoys watching himself on television, which is also the case. So I once did some awful satellite live link-up thing to CBS in America with St. John. And he had some young American researcher with him. And it was just some sort of run-of-the-mill little item going out on CBS in America. And Norman then said to this young American researcher, could you please ring your parents in America at once and ask them to record it on the video apparatus?
Three parliamentary women for you, Annabel. Anne Widdecombe, Shirley Williams, and Glenda Jackson. And their professed hobbies are hill-walking, reading Jane Austen and researching Charles II's escape. I assume you can do all three at once if that's what takes your fancy.
Oh, lordy. What dull women. I think Shirley's up the hills walking.
Correct.
And I think she should be. I think that's quite right, too. I think Anne Widdecombe is mad enough to research the escape of... What is she thinking?
But what
explains
is she
the,
on?
Explains the Cromwellian haircut. Doesn't really. which leaves... I honestly don't know. They're all... Do you have to be mad to be a woman in part? You do, don't you? Which leaves Glenda Jackson to the, you know, good heavens forsooks, there go me britches of Jane Austen, I think. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. Correct answer. You're right, Glenda Jackson's the Jane Austen fan. The hill walker is Shirley Williams, now Baroness Williams of Crosby. And it's Anne Widdecombe who really wants to escape with Charles II. And lastly in this round, Fred, yeah. Your trio is John Redwood, Sir David Steele and Simon Hughes. Their hobbies include vintage motoring, water sports, and I quote, music, open brackets, including raves, close brackets.
Raves. Oh, I think Hughes is the raver.
Correct.
Yeah. Doesn't strike you that way, though, does he? Do you think he'd dress up in 1970s bell-bottom flares and things and fantasises his way down to places?
I should take him out in the back of your cab and find out.
No, thanks. No. Steele with those funny shirts he's been wearing for the last 40 years, you know, the stripes with the white collar. Puts you in mind of a person who could have starred in Genevieve. So I think it must be him with the vintage cars, in the borders, you know, visiting his constituents and laying on hands and things. So, and Redwood goes water skiing.
Something like that.
Does he take water with him, or does he use it when he gets there?
I think he walks on it. Time now for a music round, and this week I'll play each of you a piece of music in which a person's name features in either the title or the lyrics. In each case, your task is to tell me a little about the person in question. Francis, here's a stirring little number for you.
Thank you.
gave his name to that well-known march?
It's not called the Strauss March, is it?
Nope.
Was he a Vietnamese... I'm Vietnamese.
Yes, almost certainly a Vietnamese.
Was he a Viennese general by the name of Radetzky?
Of course.
He very much was. Well done for that bonus. I think it's a well-known fact that Strauss wrote very little of his stuff in Vietnam, although he may have been Saigon, I don't know. I mean, I've never looked at it, I've never researched it.
Yeah. Tran Yan Min Waltz or something. Yeah.
That was Johann Strauss the Elder's Radetzky March, written in 1848 in support of the Austrian leader Metternich, but named in honour of one of Metternich's leading generals, Count Josef von Radetzky. Sue, your turn now. Have a listen to this.
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game.
Well, that was Bob Dylan's Only a Pawn in Their Game. In it, he refers to the death of a man called Medgar Evers. I wonder if you can tell me who he was.
Was he a black man who was lynched or something along those
lines? He was assassinated.
Assassinated.
That's right. Points over this side. Well done. He was assassinated in Jackson, Mississippi in June 1963. He was the Mississippi Field Secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He was killed on the night that John F. Kennedy went on national television to outline a bill he was sending to Congress, a bill which later became the Civil Rights Act of 1964. A local Ku Klux Klan member, Byron Dulla Beckwith, was widely suspected of Evers' murder. After a series of acquittals by all-white juries, he was finally convicted of Evers' murder in 1994, more than 30 years after the event. Annabelle, here's your piece of music.
Valerie Solanas took the elevator, got off at the fourth floor. She pointed the gun at Andy, saying, "You cannot control me anymore." I believe there's got to be some retribution. I believe an eye for an eye is elemental. I believe there's something wrong if she's alive right now.
I've never heard that piece of music in my life before.
You sound like you don't ever want to hear it again.
No, it was terrible, wasn't it?
It was Lou Reed, so it's got to be politically correct.
Yeah.
The name was Valerie Solanas.
She ran an outfit called Scum, the Society for Cutting Up Men.
Correct. And which particular man did she try to cut up?
Well, she shot Andy Warhol.
Correct. Well done. Valerie Solanas was the woman who shot Andy Warhol in 1968, feeling that Warhol had rejected her as one of his factory superstars. Warhol was actually pronounced dead, but he was resuscitated with heart massage. And as you said, Frances, she was the founder of Scum, the Society for Cutting Up Men. Warhol, who had championed Lou Reed's band, The Velvet Underground, and produced their first album, fortunately continued to work until his death in 1987.
The Scum still exist.
I don't know why you think you've joined it.
They've gone very New Labour now. It's New Scum.
Okay, finally for you, Fred. Have a listen to this.
I said, "Hey, was she on it? The new show set today."
We feel like we've got out the lift at the wrong floor over here.
Let me help you.
Is that Ricciani? Is that
no, the song, fair enough, I'll tell you what the song was called. Right. How could you tell? It was called Hey Luciani by a group called The Fall, and it's about a man called Albino Luciani. Now, can you tell me who Albino Luciani was?
It can't be Lucky Luciano, is it?
No, no. I mean, actually about as far from Lucky Luciano as is possible
to
get.
It's got to be Pope or something.
Pope, yes.
Oh, well done.
This is not John Paul I, the one that only lasted for about 5 minutes. Yeah. And of course, this is where the ghost of Luciano comes in, because it was all tied up. Allegedly, he was done away with by various groups in Italy, and that's it. So the other guy came along and was very original and called himself John Paul II.
He was Pope John Paul I, died just 33 days after his installation in the Vatican in 1978. His sudden demise gave rise to a number of conspiracy theories, as you mentioned, Fred, implicating, amongst others, the papal court, the Vatican Bank, and the Freemasons. Well, why not?
You missed out the T and G, didn't you?
In this next round, I'll ask the teams to find a connection between two famous people. In each case, the connection I'm looking for is a third famous person. It may sound complicated, but it really isn't. Francis will now demonstrate. Francis, who links Roald Amundsen with Vaughan Williams?
Oh, well, it's Vaughan Williams wrote the film score for the film of Scott of the Antarctic.
Correct! And Amundsen, well done. Yes, indeed. The answer is Captain Scott. Amundsen, of course, famously beat Scott in the fateful race to the South Pole. And Vaughan Williams wrote the film score, Sinfonia Antarctica, for that film, as you mentioned, Francis, Scott of the Antarctic. Sue, your turn. Can you tell me who connects former US President George Bush with the actress Jane Wyman?
Well, could Ronnie Reagan be the link here?
Yes.
Perhaps?
Well done. The link is Ronald Reagan. Bush spent 8 years as Reagan's vice president, while Reagan's first wife was Jane Wyman. Annabelle, can you please suggest who connects the pop star Phil Collins with the great train robber, Ronnie Biggs?
The Flower Seller Buster. Edwards is a flower seller at Waterloo Station, and he was once a train robber, and there's a film, and you know everything I'm trying to say, but put it in your own order.
Well, that seemed to me worth 2 points of anybody's
money. Thank you very much.
Fred, who connects Sergei Diaghilev with Lester Pigott?
Oh, Nijinsky. Yeah. I suddenly thought he never rode Diaghilev, did he? Unless,
we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. That's
I
true.
Think it's quite old. Yeah, we don't know. Types.
Beyond our ken, if they say, yeah. There's all ballet dancers and horses and...
The answer is Vaslav Nijinsky, who was the brightest star in Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, and after whom Lester Pigott's Derby winner, perhaps finest ever mount, was named. As for Nijinsky himself, his brilliant career was cut short at the age of just 27 when he was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. Let's quickly check on what that's done to the scores. Oh, they're still dead level. It's going to be exciting at the end here. Francis and Sue have 23. Fred and Annabelle also have 23. Our next round is called Also Known As, and looks at the nicknames, pseudonyms, and indeed original names of various noteworthy characters. In each case, our panellists have to tell me how they were more famously known. Francis, how did Georges Remy find success after an initial reversal?
Well, he was Belgian, and if you live in Belgium, certainly in the 1920s if you lived in Belgium, there wasn't very much to do of an evening, so he amused himself by switching his initials round.
It can't have taken long.
So instead of being J.R., he became R.G. and wrote The Adventures of Tintin.
Absolutely right. Turning to you, Sue. In what sense was Guy the Gorilla beefy?
Yeah, it's in Botham, this, isn't it, Guy the Gorilla? And
yes,
what sense
it is.
Beefy, beefy Botham.
Do you like to go through any of the statistics of his illustrious career, or would that be too cruel?
Well, by balls or by...
You want to explain every wicket he took?
Oh, no, I don't think I'm going to the wickets, though. No, I won't go to the wickets, definitely.
Well done. Very good. They were both nicknames of the cricketery in Botham, as Sue said. Arguably England's finest ever all-rounder. This one is for you, Annabelle. In what sense is it little wonder that Steveland Judkins found fame under a different name? Steveland Judkins.
That's Stevie Wonder, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Good for you. Finally, Fred, for you. How did Camille Javal find alliterative acclaim?
Haven't got a clue.
Became great animal rights.
Yes, I was about to say, is it not Brigitte Bardot?
It
Brigitte
is. Bonus point there. Camille Javal was indeed Brigitte Bardot. Our final round is called The Name Lives On, and is all about people to whom posterity has paid the ultimate compliment. They've all been immortalized by having something named after them. Francis, who said, "One more such victory and we are lost," and his name lives on as a result.
Well, we talk about Pyrrhic victories here.
We are. Well done.
So it would be Pyrrhus, the answer to your question, I suppose.
Pyrrhus is the right one, a cousin of Alexander the Great. Do you know after which battle he said it?
I was rather hoping you wouldn't ask that. No.
It was the Battle of Asculum. And although his forces won the battle, they suffered catastrophic losses. And as you said, his name lives on in the phrase Pyrrhic victory. Sue, for which Scottish chemist did every cloud have a silver lining?
McIntosh
is the correct answer. It's Charles McIntosh who first patented the waterproof coat. He made his crucial breakthrough in 1823 when trying to find practical uses for waste products from gasworks. Annabelle,
yes.
Can you tell me which wartime prime minister entered the language by collaboration?
Is it something to do with Norway? Or is it just... Oh, Quisling!
Quisling! This refers to Vidkun Quisling, who was installed by the Nazis as Prime Minister in Norway. He held the post between 1940 and 1945, after which he gave himself up to the Allies and was tried and executed. The word Quisling has come to mean anyone who acts as a puppet leader for an occupying power, or more generally, who collaborates with the enemy. Fred, how did Francis Bailey's name return to prominence on August the 11th, 1999? Sue!
Well, that was the date of the eclipse.
It was.
He obviously predicted it, or worked it all out, exactly where it was going to kind of be. And
the audience has got it. We're the dumb ones on this one.
The audience have got it.
Yeah.
Go on. Bailey's Bees. Congratulate yourselves. Have a good clap. Very good. Sue was right. August the 11th was the date of the solar eclipse, and the phenomenon known as Bailey's beads is named after the astronomer Francis Bailey. Bailey first noticed his beads during an eclipse in 1836, and his other great... Poor chap. Took him all that time. His other great scientific achievement was calculating the mean density of the Earth. Well, the end of that round also brings us to the end of the show. And a glance at the final scores... is astonishing. There's been a great run-up by Fred Housko and Annabelle Giles to 27, but Francis and Sue have made 33. So I just have to end by thanking all our panellists, Francis Wien, Sue Cook, Annabelle Giles, and Fred Housko. Until the same time next week, goodbye. Who Goes There was hosted by me, Martin Young. It was written by Hugh Rycroft and Nick Hildred, and the producer was Liz Anstey.